This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. This week had the potential to be a good one for Republicans in the White House. Amidst the political infighting, the looming threat of the Mueller investigation, and the constant dread of an administration and damage control, the White House was preparing for a big win, the Senate confirmation hearings of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. But those hearings have been anything but quiet.
Mr. Chairman, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
Chairman, I move to adjourn.
This is the first confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice I've seen according to mob rule.
Is there a person you're talking about?
I'm asking you a very direct question, yes or no.
I'm not sure I know everyone who works at that law firm.
You're out of order.
There is clearly a rule that applies.
Then apply the rule, Chairman, and bring the charges.
And the hearing's also not the most dramatic thing happening in Washington. First was the news of yet another book that paints a picture of a White House in crisis, this time by legendary reporter Bob Woodward, who has hundreds of hours of testimony recounting top White House officials who have no faith in the commander-in-chief and who think he's unfit to serve. According to the book, his chief of staff, John Kelly, thinks the president is, quote, unhinged, and said, quote, he's an idiot. It's pointless to try to convince him of anything. He's gone off the rails. We're in crazy town. I don't even know why any of us are here. This is the worst job I've ever had, unquote. As the White House was reeling from those revelations, another bomb dropped.
The latest act of resistance is the op-ed published in the failing New York Times by an anonymous, gutless coward.
He's, of course, referring to the now infamous op-ed written by an anonymous administration official who says even folks in Trump's most inner circles are part of the resistance, that they discussed invoking the 25th Amendment, and that they remain in their jobs to both advance the Republican agenda and, more importantly, to keep Trump in check. The president has called this treasonous.
Unelected deep state operatives who defy the voters to push their own secret agendas are truly a threat to democracy itself.
So basically, just another typical crazy news week in Washington. To discuss the whirlwind of a week, I spoke with Dana Bash, political correspondent for CNN, and Phil Rucker, White House bureau chief for The Washington Post. So Dana, there has been a lot of drama this week in the hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, but how much of it is going to make a real impact on the perceptions of the Supreme Court nominee? And do you think this is going to actually move any votes? Is there any real impediments to his confirmation?
Right now, it does not look like there are any real impediments to his confirmation. But your phrase was really important, to move perceptions. What you're seeing here are Democrats understandably trying to move perceptions or shape perceptions of a very, very angry and fired up Democratic base. Just the fact that they spent the whole second morning arguing about process, arguing about what's secret and what's not secret, gives you a very, very big sense of how high the stakes are for these Democrats. Not only in this year where you're seeing, you know, race after race of traditional incumbent Democrats being picked off from the left in their own party because the base is so sick of, you know, politics as usual. This is the same pattern we saw, of course, on the GOP side starting about 10 years ago. You're seeing, of course, just as we saw when Senator Barack Obama was in the Senate, Senator Hillary Clinton was in the Senate, on this particular committee, people who are seriously considering a run for their own presidency in which they have to court the Democratic base, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, trying to appeal to those very fired up voters.
So when we saw Cory Booker makes very impassioned appeal about some of these documents.
I'm going to release the email about racial profiling. And I understand that the penalty comes with potential ousting from the Senate. And if Senator Cornyn believes that I violated Senate rules, I openly invite and accept the consequences of my team releasing that email right now. And I'm releasing it to expose that, number one, the emails that are being withheld from the public have nothing to do with national security, nothing to jeopardize the sanctity of those ideals that I hold dear.
Is your suggestion, Dana, that this was more of an appeal to a Democratic primary 2020 base than it was to an actual problem that Booker was having with the process?
I think it's both. I do, in fairness, see that these senators are frustrated with the process, that they've been asking for these documents from the Bush administration for a long time. They're frustrated that it was a Republican political operative who was the gatekeeper, so on and so forth. However, there's no question there is theater going on here. And just the fact that Senator Booker spent the morning talking about how he's civil disobedience and he's going to put these out, and it turns out, at least at the time, the documents that he was putting out were already released by the Republicans. I mean, of course, it's a combination of the two, but it has the added benefit politically. He wants the substance, to be fair, has the added benefit politically of being something that he believes that could help him in a very big way. And he knows that everybody knows, anybody who has not been under a rock for the past 2 years knows that the base is chomping at the bit for.
One more topic I want to talk with you about, Dana, is abortion. Judge Kavanaugh has refused to say how he'd rule if an abortion case came before the court.
Can you commit, sitting here today, that you would never overturn Roe v. Wade?
So, Senator, each of the 8 justices currently on the Supreme Court, when they were in this seat, declined to answer that question.
I understand your answer. You've given it on other issues before. But you can understand also, given what we've seen in Garza and the pattern here of sending a signal about your willingness to overturn Roe v. Wade, that your response leaves in serious question your commitment to this precedent.
Do you see this issue now as something that could actually become more significant in the confirmation hearings? We've been hearing for a while now that 2 Republican senators, Collins, Murkowski, have made the issue of Roe v. Wade. They said it's very important to them in their decision-making process. Do you think this moved the ball on that?
It's unclear because Brett Kavanaugh was decidedly murky. I mean, it's hard for me to believe, watching Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins over many years, that despite the fact that they are ardently for abortion rights, they're also looking at a Supreme Court nominee who is the choice of an elected president. And it's still really hard for me to wrap my mind around Republicans saying no to a president's choice for the Supreme Court, who is very, very qualified.
Phil, we're going to change gears here for a second and go to the White House, your beat. And we've had 2 big developments this week, the book that is coming out by Bob Woodward, and then, of course, the New York Times op-ed the other day. Phil, I just have this feeling like we've been here before, right? Like, reports come out, whether it's in a book or off-the-record quotes from people within the White House saying, this place is crazy, it's off the rails, the president has to be managed. Is this different? I mean, are we in a different place now with these 2 pieces of information, these 2 documents, than we were before?
Yeah, well, Amy, you're right that it sounds familiar. It's all sort of part of the same canon of Trump. But this feels a little different for a couple of reasons. One, just the depth of the reporting in Bob Woodward's book takes us to a new level. And that op-ed was extraordinary. That was a deliberate statement that a senior official who's only identified as a senior official decided to make. It wasn't an anonymous quote in a story. It was a complete condemnation of this president's leadership. And what it shows is that there is a resistance force within the government, that it's not just this official, but it's, you know, at the time it was Gary Cohn, the Economic Council chairman, who would take papers off the president's desk. It's Jim Mattis, who wouldn't necessarily act on all of the president's impulsive directives, and others. And they're acting as guardrails against him, trying to manipulate him, and in some cases outright ignoring his orders and operating based on their own beliefs about what they need to do to protect the country, even if it's in conflict with the whims and wishes of the commander-in-chief.
And Phil, does it feel different now at the White House? Like, as you are talking to people, is there a different sort of perception of the president and where things are going to go from here?
Yeah, it doesn't feel that different over there simply because I think so many of the advisors and aides to the president are pretty numb to this. They've experienced it firsthand for months, if not, a year and a half if they began at the beginning. But based on my reporting, the president feels different. He feels as paranoid as he's ever been. He feels isolated. He's anger. His mood in this sort of 48-hour period of these two bombshells landing has vacillated from volcanic anger to just kind of disappointment and betrayal. But he feels very much alone. He doesn't know who in the government he can trust. He has commented to some people that he feels like he can only trust his family members. And there's a real fear among his allies and advisors that this could really go off the rails. And, more and more bad news is only going to pile up potentially, and that he may not be able to handle it well.
Yeah. So what does that look like, do you think, Phil, a president who's more isolated, who feels, sort of untethered to anybody around him except for his family? What could that actually mean in terms of actions?
Well, you could see a couple of things. One, you could see him trying to figure out how to exercise his executive power. We've seen over the course of his presidency that in the first phase, he very much deferred to his advisors. This was all new to him. He didn't really fully comprehend what he could do. He wasn't fully comfortable making decisions on his own. And what you could see now, what allies fear could happen, is that he increasingly feels emboldened to act alone.
Right. And for both of you, do you all think that things like this, the op-ed and the book, do you think this moves the ball at all in terms of perceptions of the electorate and their willingness to support a Democratic or Republican candidate in the fall?
I was doing some reporting on this very question, Amy, asking around to Republican operatives who are trying desperately to hold on to the House in particular. And the answer was, yes, it has an impact. First and foremost, I was told it has had an impact on fundraising, which is no small thing. Secondly, I am told that, look what happened in Montana, that when the president goes and he rants and raves about things like the Woodward book or the op-ed, of course it fires up the base, which is not a bad thing in a place like Montana, but it also crowds out the messages that the actual candidates who are on the ballot are trying to put forward. And that's very frustrating to a lot of these Republican candidates, particularly, Amy, you know this better than anybody, since the control of the House is going to be fought and is going to be won or lost in the suburbs, where independent voters, women, are going to be decisive, and those are the groups who are most turned off by the president's behavior, but also, more importantly, the chaos. Just like, enough already. Let me just check the mark or pull the lever for the Democrat just to have some check on this craziness in Washington. That's the concern among Republicans.
Phil, the president is out, as Dana said, in Montana, and then he's going to be in North Dakota today. Is that what we're going to see for the next 60 days here, the president trying to escape the White House as much as possible and just basically spend all the time on the road, number one? And number two, as Dana also mentioned, how many Republicans actually want him to be campaigning in their state?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because you have to almost think of the midterms as two completely different election cycles. You have the House races, which, as Dana noted, are mostly in, or many of the competitive races are in these suburban districts where Trump is pretty polarizing. Those House Republicans don't want to be anywhere near the president. And then a lot of the Senate Republican candidates who are trying to knock off Democratic incumbents in states where Trump is still popular and where he won in 2016 want him there campaigning for him. That's why you see Trump going so often to Montana, to North Dakota, to West Virginia, where I think he'll be back probably several times before November. And he's really keeping an eye on those Senate races because the House candidates simply don't want him around. But to your first question, does Trump want to be out there? Absolutely. This is his favorite part of being president, is flying around on Air Force One and doing big rallies in front of adoring crowds. If he could just be a campaigner and candidate, he would love it.
Phil Rucker, Dana Bash, thank you guys so much.
This is such a great way to
thank
end
you.
The week.
Thank you.